You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 22nd of June 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, I thought today we would continue with our little look at what's going on in Africa that we've done for the last couple of episodes, just beginning with a news article from South Africa. And we talked yesterday about the problems with corruption that there are in Africa. That was one of the main concerns that black African youth have about the continent, really, not just their own countries, and being a reason for why they wish to emigrate to Europe and America. And this is a news article from the Sunday Times from South Africa, which gives us an idea of the levels of corruption that there now are in that country. The police service is becoming a Trojan horse for criminals, looking to neutralise any form of trust citizens might have left in the country's criminal justice system, said Ian Cameron, the Director of Community Safety at Action Society. So things are now getting so bad that the police force itself is becoming no better than a criminal gang. Action Society's latest police trust indicator survey has revealed 92% of South African road users feel unsafe when police pull them over. Furthermore, data showed most drivers felt unsure whether they should trust the police members who stopped them. Now, this is really serious because these are the people that are supposed to be upholding the law and preventing crime. And yet 90% of road users feel that they cannot trust them because they are more likely to be criminals than they are to be police. Approximately 50% of drivers indicated that they had been asked for or demanded to pay bribe money by police members who had pulled them over. And this is quite endemic in the third world, particularly in Asia, where we also have this problem in Africa. And when we import people from these countries into Europe, we are inevitably going to get a percentage of people that are susceptible to this sort of behaviour. And we're going to be getting people that are used to this sort of behaviour. And it makes me wonder what the corruption figures are like in Britain and in Europe and whether they have gone up since immigration has gone up. And perhaps it could be tied to people that are susceptible to corruption coming in from these countries that obviously have very high levels of corruption. The data also showed that more than 75% of police members don't introduce themselves once they have stopped a driver. And we should also bear in mind here that South Africa is one of the countries that young black African youth wish to go to. They think that this is going to be similar to Europe or America when they get there. And this is something that Rwanda is going to have to be very careful to not allow happen there, because at the moment 60% of the people in Rwanda are happy and think that the country is going in the right direction. Whereas, obviously, people in South Africa are concerned if 90% of them feel that they cannot trust the police force. At a time when bogus police and criminal cops terrorise innocent citizens more than ever, these statistics emphasise the dire need for police reform in South Africa, said Cameron. According to him, solutions are simple. Number one, do a skills audit in the police service to determine the merit of appointments and sack members not appointed on merit. Interesting, over here in Britain now, we have diversity quotas in the police. So people over here in Britain are not being appointed on merit. They're being appointed on their diversity quotient. And whether they are black or non-white or homosexual, all those things now count for something when somebody is being interviewed in the police because they have these diversity quotas. Yet where do we end up with diversity quotas? Well, we can see in Africa here, South Africa, where you have people that are not employed on merit but are employed for other reasons, you run the risk of taking people into the police force that are susceptible to corruption. Number two, polygraph all members, starting with the leadership, to determine whether they have been involved in corrupt activities. If so, fire them. Number three, restore crime intelligence capabilities. Number four, reinstate specialised units that can effectively deal with serious violent crime without having to live in the community where they work. Number five, crime kingpins, including those with state connections, must be targeted and taken out of operation. Number six, restore reservist capabilities specifically to support specialised units. It is of utmost importance. Reservists do not come from the communities for intimidation to be limited. Number seven, pay police members properly. Number eight, implement police devolution in the Western Cape as a proof of concept. And he finishes off by saying, in the latest quarterly crime statistics released by the police service, kidnapping was spoken of as especially worrying, with more than 37 kidnappings reported per day, or more than 1,000 per month. Considering the threat fake police or criminal police members may hold to possible kidnapping victims, the trust indicator data paints a very dark picture for the future. And we have to bear in mind that story that we heard the other day of somebody that there was an attempted kidnap attempt against him, and he ran into a shop expecting to be able to get help, and the people in the shop then tried to kidnap him. I mean, this is a serious problem that they're dealing with in Africa. I mean, it is pretty much lawless over there when you look at this, and 90% of people in South Africa are concerned that they can't trust the police. And you have to wonder whether people thought they could trust the police when South Africa had apartheid. We're told this was such a terrible thing that black people were separated from white people, but I'm sure that back then they felt that they could trust the police a lot more than they do now. Corruption is rampant over there, and that's one of the reasons why people are coming into Europe and America. So we really need to help them out with their corruption, don't we, to be honest, if we want to prevent them from coming into our countries. As I say, that's going to be one of the things that Rwanda is going to have to look very carefully at. Well, leaving Africa for now and heading over to China. China has been making some interesting comments about freedom of speech. China has branded the US and the United Kingdom hypocrites on press freedom over the looming extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to face espionage charges that could land the Australian in jail for life. And we're constantly being told that China is a communist country and there is no journalistic freedom there. Yet you can talk about anything you like in China, apart from directly criticising the Communist Party and the sort of communism that they have. It's not international communism, it's a socialism with Chinese characteristics. So the important word there is the ethnic denominator, Chinese. So what they're actually talking about there is nationalist socialism. So you cannot criticise the party, but you can criticise policies, and clearly they want their people to criticise the policies if they can come out with solutions to them and better ideas for them. And this is the critique that I have of the British government. I mean, all we do as nationalists, we identify government policies and we identify negative effects that they are having on the Indigenous Britons, and we suggest solutions to them. And you would think that a government would be pleased that the citizens that it governs were taking an interest and looking at society and trying to find ways to improve that society. But instead of that, we get accused of being haters and blaming minorities and inciting hate against minorities. You know, nothing could be further from the truth. We are actually identifying problems that have occurred due to government policy, policies which don't actually help the minorities in their homelands any more than they help us. I mean, how does it help black Africans to have all their intelligent ones coming over to Europe instead of staying in Africa to help their country out? How does it help them to the Christian Somalians to come over to London and live in London where their teenagers then get involved in knife crime and the parents then have to send them back because they're involved in a multicultural city then? Instead of being surrounded all by other Somalian elders, they're surrounded by all different types of people and all different types of criminals there as well. And with the potential that there is for victimization in multicultural territories, because it's always going to be easier for a criminal to find a potential victim from another people group to his own than it is to find a victim amongst his own group, because he's more likely to be identified for a start by somebody from his own group. So when we point out that multiculturalism harms the indigenous Britons, it also harms these minorities as well. And the solutions that we try to come up with are going to be solutions that are going to help these people as just as much as they're going to help us. And yet we're told that we're inciting hate against them. Somehow I think that if we were in China and you were a Chinese nationalist and you were suggesting ways to improve Chinese society and pointing out perhaps that multiculturalism in an area was not helping China, I don't think the Chinese authorities would be accusing the people of inciting hate. I think they would be saying, well, what are your suggestions? And let's have a public debate about this. But what they're doing here is they are condemning what's being done to Julian Assange. Assange's extradition to the US to face charges over the leaking of thousands of official secrets has been approved by British Home Secretary Priti Patel after a protracted legal battle. And there is issues over this, over what Julian Assange has done, because I do believe what they're accusing him of doing is making the names and addresses known of people that were collaborators working with the occupational American government in Afghanistan, which quite clearly put these people at risk. But Julian Assange is saying that all those names were blanked out. And they did ask beforehand, before they produced this information, they said, look, please tell us what we should be removing. But I don't believe the authorities wanted to work with him and say what to remove. So there is that issue there, but Julian Assange is not an American citizen. Julian Assange was an Australian citizen. So if he wanted to publish this information, why is it that the United States feel that he should come under American law when he wasn't in the United States at the time? Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin accuses the US of pursuing trumped-up charges against Assange for exposing secrets about the US wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and about the CIA's cyber attacks against other countries. And it was some very important information that Assange revealed about the tools that the CIA had and how they could make it look like it was another country that was carrying out these cyber attacks. And also what he exposed in Iraq and Afghanistan was the killing of civilians and torturing that was going on. And at the time, he was really feted by the mainstream media. But then once he started exposing what Hillary Clinton was up to, then he suddenly fell out of favour and then he became the bad guy and the press were not interested in him any longer. And you have to say with Assange, he's not right-wing and he's not left-wing. I mean, one of the things he did, he exposed all the supporters of the BNP. The BNP members list was put up there on the WikiLeaks website. So it's not as if Assange was supportive of nationalist politics. Yet at the same time, he's also exposed Hillary Clinton. I mean, he really is just wanting to put information out there, I guess. And you could say, well, it was very risky of him to put out the BNP members list. That's why I'm suspicious that, you know, maybe he did put out the names of these Afghan collaborators and that would have put them at risk. The US and Britain are cooperating in cross-border crackdowns on certain individuals, he said. This is the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman. The case of Assange is a mirror that shows how hypocritical the US and Britain's claim to uphold press freedom is. And I would also point out that this incitement to hate and this accusation of hate speech, that also clamps down on press freedom. Maybe not the mainstream media freedom, but it certainly clamps down on the alternative media, and it prevents citizen journalists from talking about the issues that they want to talk about. If the issues that they want to talk about have been caused by multiculturalism, then they run the risk of being accused of hate speech. If the issues they want to talk about are linked to the sexualization of children, then they run the risk of being accused of homophobia or transphobia. And the effect of that is the same, isn't it? It ends up producing censorship, and you end up with social media silencing people. You end up with people being deplatformed, being debanked, losing their jobs. You end up with Hope Not Hate going after them. There are all these different ways to censor people talking about subjects that the government don't want you to talk about, basically pretending that everybody has the same opinion as the government. That is the effect of this. So he's pointing out here that this example of Assange here shows that Britain's claim to uphold press freedom is not what it's meant to be. But there are other issues as well, which, you know, the Chinese should point out, I think. They should point out the way that people are silenced if they're critical of government policy on multiculturalism or government policy on homosexuality, transgenderism, all these things that we should be free to discuss, and there should be a public debate about it. We're just not allowed to debate it because we get accused of phobias and hate speech. He says people enjoy fully freedoms to expose other countries and will be regarded as heroes if they do so, but they will be severely punished and considered to be criminals if they expose their own country or its allies and partners. And yes, you could say, well, that's not really patriotic. It's not loyal to your own country to expose your own country or put your own country at risk. But what Assange was doing was exposing wrongdoing. And if there is wrongdoing that is going on, then it should be exposed. We should support whistleblowers to expose where those sorts of things are going on, where the law is being broken, because we should all be obeying the law. It shouldn't be one law for one part of society and another law for another. It should be one law for everyone. And if you see something going on that shouldn't be going on, you need to expose that. I mean, I would argue that's the same thing that we're doing as nationalists. We can see hazards, upcoming hazards that society is going to encounter, and we are trying to warn people about these upcoming hazards, and we're trying to come out with ways that these hazards can be avoided. But we just get accused of hate speech for doing that. You would think that the government would thank us for pointing these things out. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken in May called China the biggest worldwide threat to press freedom, citing how many journalists were detained and accusing the communist regime of increasing surveillance, harassment and intimidation. And what you've got to think about there is how many journalists are actually linked up with the intelligence services. There was a big expose of that in the 70s, and it was something like 50 or 60% of journalists were linked to the CIA, and a lot of these journalists that are in foreign countries also double up as spies. I mean, they're there in a foreign country as a foreign correspondent, finding out information. I mean, obviously, they're going to be the people that the intelligence services are going to go to. So I would suggest that the journalists that have been detained here by China were probably detained for good reason. They were probably detained for trying to find out state secrets, more so than criticizing Chinese government policy. Mr. Wenbin accused the US of trumping up charges of sexual assault, espionage, and computer misuse against Assange, and of also pursuing the activist through secret surveillance, backstage deals, and other means. I mean, he was supposed to be under asylum. He was supposed to be giving asylum in that Ecuadorian embassy. So quite how he could then be arrested from there and taken out, I don't know. He was supposed to have diplomatic immunity at that embassy. Quite clearly, there were backstage deals that went on. I think Ecuador was given quite a large backhander. Millions of dollars from the World Bank, something like that, I seem to remember, went on. Assange was accused of raping two women in Sweden, but fled to the Ecuadorian embassy in London before he could be arrested and extradited. And that was his fears, that if he was extradited to Sweden, he would then be extradited to America, I believe. The rape charges were eventually dropped due to Assange's protracted asylum in the embassy, but the US never gave up on the espionage accusations. Mr. Wenbin said all eyes would be on Mr. Assange's human rights and expressed the hope that justice would prevail over abuse and hegemony. Well, the United States does have hegemony, and it doesn't look like justice is prevailing here, because he is being given up from Britain to America, and he's an Australian citizen. Surely an Australian citizen has a right to criticize America if they want to. And so long as Assange didn't actually go to America, it's not really right that America can just extradite him from Britain. America doesn't have any extradition treaties with any countries. You can't say, ah, this American citizen has carried out a crime over here in our country, will you extradite him to us? America doesn't have those kinds of treaties. Neither does Israel. But America expects other countries to do that for them. Assange faces up to 175 years in prison on 18 charges in the US under the Espionage Act for leaking classified documents in 2010 and 2011. But he's not American, though. So how is he carrying out espionage against America, or how can he be charged with doing this? Obviously, it was somebody else that was in America that was getting these classified documents and then handing them over to him. And surely he's not under any duty to return them to America if they contained evidence of wrongdoing, evidence of crimes. I mean, that's what he was doing. He was exposing crimes. He is in London's Belmarsh Jail, serving time for breaching bail after his long attempt to gain asylum in Ecuador unraveled, and he was arrested after leaving the embassy, where he had been holed up for about 7 years. I think, Ecuador basically said they were going to no longer give him asylum. The US government said his leaking of thousands of classified diplomatic cables put the lives of US soldiers and those working secretly for the Americans at risk. And that could very well be true. I mean, that could have happened. But what Assange is saying is that he took every reasonable step he could be expected to take to avoid that from happening, by contacting the US government and saying, look, we have this information here, it shows wrongdoing, we don't want to put anybody at risk here, will you tell us the names to blank out? Or if we send you this, will you blank out the names? Something like that did actually go on, and that's Julian Assange's defense. His defenders argue he exposed US war crimes and human rights abuses in Guantanamo Bay, in Cuba, Iraq, and Afghanistan, as well as revealing the CIA's covert activities against its own citizens. So he was exposing crimes. The US Justice Department also accuses Assange of illegal hacking in helping Chelsea Manning, a former intelligence analyst, get the classified information. And again, that's very, very sketchy. I mean, it was Chelsea Manning that got this information. He, who is now a she, handed it over to Assange. Clearly, it's Manning that was in the wrong here. Manning was convicted of 17 charges for a role in leaking the documents in 2013 and convicted to spend 35 years in a maximum security prison. However, they were released in 2017 when outgoing US President Barack Obama commuted the sentence to the years they had already served in confinement since arrest in 2010. So Chelsea Manning is not in prison. It's Assange they want to go after. There have been calls for Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, that's in Australia, to make a public plea on behalf of Assange, which so far he has resisted. And he should be doing this because Assange is an Australian citizen. It should be Anthony Albanese who is responsible for him, who tries to get him back. But clearly, Australia is deferring to America here. Employment Minister Tony Burke said the government was making quiet, behind-the-scenes representations to the US over the case. "We are not going to conduct diplomacy by megaphone," Mr. Burke told Sky News on Sunday. "This case has gone on for far too long. We said that in opposition, and we have repeated that in government. The issue needs to be brought to a close. Australia is not a party to the prosecution that is happening here, and each country has its own legal system." That's the point, really. Each country has its own legal system. If somebody commits a crime within that country, then they need to be tried. But if somebody is in another country altogether and they are exposing crimes that took place in your country or were carried out by your country, then you don't really have a right to be trying them. What you should be doing is trying the people that were carrying out the crimes within your own country. And surely this has gone on for long enough. If you look at the state of Assange, he's in a very weakened physical state after being effectively within solitary confinement for years in the Ecuadorian embassy. But the point here is really freedom of speech and freedom of the press is something that we're told we have in the Western liberal democracies, but which clearly we don't have if they've gone after Assange. I mean, what about all the leakers that the mainstream media journalists have? They all have their informants that leak information, and that's all Julian Assange was doing, is what these journalists were doing. Perhaps because he wasn't an accredited journalist, he wasn't a mainstream media journalist, maybe that's why they're going after him again. So he was a citizen journalist, part of the alternative media. So you can basically, what they're saying is you can only put information out there that the government tells you you can put out there. You're not allowed to have a differing opinion. And just finally, to finish up with here, we have another example of the hypocrisy of the liberal democracies. Ukraine, supposedly this beacon of democracy over there in the east, that is being invaded by the fascist dictator Vladimir Putin, has apparently banned the country's main opposition party and seized all its assets, once again undermining the narrative that President Zelensky is presiding over a beacon of democracy. I mean, they've already banned loads of opposition parties over there, and now they've banned the main one. I mean, it's like the Conservative Party banning the Labour Party. The country's Ministry of Justice announced the move via Facebook, revealing that the opposition Platform for Life had been shut down and its assets, money and property transferred to the state. So, I mean, that is a dictatorship, isn't it, when you ban all the other opposition parties, and yet they're claiming that Ukraine is a democracy. In a democracy, you're supposed to be able to hear everybody's point of view, you're supposed to be able to organise around your point of view. And the general idea is that you come to some form of agreement. You talk things out between all of you until a majority of you agree. If you're just going to ban people with a different opinion to you, then that's not a democracy, is it? The party had previously had its operations suspended in March after it was accused of being complicit with Russia and being anti-Ukrainian. The ban means that Zelensky's main political opposition has been eliminated. The OPPL was the second largest party in the country, and its popularity surpassed that of Zelensky's Servant of the People party last year. So it was a bigger party than Zelensky's party, and he's just banned it. I mean, what about all the people that supported this party? Who have they now got to represent them? Its leader, Viktor Medvedchuk, who claims he is merely looking out for the interests of the Ukrainian people by seeking better relations with Russia, was placed under house arrest last month. And this is the sort of thing that we hear about going on in Burma, when we heard about Aung San Suu Kyi and how she was under house arrest all this time and how she wasn't allowed to take part in democracy. And all these things that we accuse other countries of doing, we end up doing here in the West, in our liberal democracies. It is absolute hypocrisy. The announcement said the party was suspected of acting to undermine the sovereignty of Ukraine, with authorities already having banned 10 other political opposition parties for the same reason. I'm surprised they're not accusing them of of hate speech. I mean, that is the same thing, isn't it? They accuse them of hate speech and then you can silence them. And what they do in Ukraine is they accuse them of undermining the sovereignty of Ukraine, basically by saying that they don't want to be enemies with their next door neighbours. Last month, President Zelensky signed a bill into law that gave the green light to ban any party that challenged the government's policy on the Russian invasion, empowering courts to seize assets without the right to appeal. So if you disagree with the government's policy, that's it. They're going to arrest you, seize your assets, and you don't have the right to appeal. And again, that is so similar to challenging the government's policy on multiculturalism, isn't it? You'll be accused of incitement to hate, and that will empower the police to take all your possessions and charge you with incitement to hate and attempt to silence you for disagreeing with government policy. Again, that is not a democracy when that sort of thing is allowed to go on. While opposition parties are being obliterated, Ukrainians who engage in dissent are also being rounded up and arrested by armed men from the Ukraine Security Service. And not just Ukrainians, there have been quite a few foreign journalists that has happened to. There have been quite a few foreign journalists who have just completely disappeared, and it's rumoured that they've been murdered over there. And yet we're told that Ukraine is this wonderful liberal democracy that needs to be defended from Putin in the East. I don't recall hearing of this sort of thing going on in Russia. I don't recall hearing of any opposition parties being silenced. I think they have quite a few different parties over there representing lots of different points of view, going all the way from left-wing communism to right-wing pro-white nationalism. They have all sorts of parties over there in Russia. They don't ban them for having a different opinion to the mainstream party. And the mainstream party does have a lot of support. Putin's party has about 80 or 90% support of the country. So quite clearly, they're doing something right. Quite clearly, Zelensky is not doing something right if he has to ban 11 different opposition parties, including the main one. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.